From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a former Bush administration lawyer explains why he resigned. Jack Goldsmith became the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in October 2003. The office advises the president on whether his plans can be legally implemented. Goldsmith concluded that many of the opinions written in the office before his arrival were deeply flawed and that some of our most important counterterrorism policies rested on severely shaky legal foundations. Goldsmith's new book is called The Terror Presidency. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Western 310 to Yuma, and we have a review of three new shows on HBO this weekend. A new series, a new special, and a season premiere. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we're going to return to a subject examined earlier this week, the expansion of executive power during the George W. Bush administration. We're about to hear the interview Terry recorded yesterday with Jack Goldsmith. Goldsmith spent 9 months as head of the Office of Legal Counsel, the OLC. This office advises the president and the attorney general on whether the president's plans can be implemented legally. According to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Charlie Savage, who was on our show earlier this week, if the president wants to do something the office interprets as illegal, the duty of the office's attorneys is to say that it cannot be done. But this role also gives those attorneys the power to preemptively absolve officials of wrongdoing. When Jack Goldsmith was appointed to head the OLC in October 2003, he concluded that some of the most important opinions that had come out of the office before he arrived were deeply flawed and sloppily reasoned. He retracted two now infamous opinions, known as the torture memos. After retracting those memos, he resigned, only 9 months after arriving. Goldsmith tells his story in his new book, The Terror Presidency: Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. Goldsmith is now a law professor at Harvard University. Although his book is not published officially until Monday, it is making news already for several reasons, including a couple of statements he attributes to David Addington. Addington is Vice President Cheney's former legal counsel and current chief of staff. Addington was a major figure in the secret planning of the War on Terrorism's legal strategy and is a strong advocate of the expansion of executive power. Goldsmith and Addington often were at odds. Terry spoke with Jack Goldsmith yesterday. She asked him about one of his confrontations with Addington.
You quote him as saying some things in the book that are already being quoted a lot on the internet and are striking some people as very extreme. And I'd like your reaction to these things that he said.
Okay.
You write that when you were trying to put an important counterterrorism initiative on a proper legal footing, he said, "If you rule that way, the blood of the 100,000 people who die in the next attack will be on your hands." How do you interpret what he said and what he meant your reaction to be to that?
I think, in some sense, Addington did not need to say what he was saying to me. To the extent he was saying, Goldsmith, if you make a decision that ties the president's hands, that disables him from doing the things that he thinks are necessary to prevent the next attack, and a lot of people die, then in some sense you are going to be the person responsible for that, especially since he didn't agree with my legal decision. And in some sense, I knew that. I mean, I was well aware of the pressures. We all the top lawyers in the administration faced conflicting pressures. On the one hand, there was enormous pressure to do everything possible, everything legally possible, to push right up to the edge of the law, to have our spikes on the chalk, as General Hayden once said, to do everything we could to allow the president to do everything he could to prevent the next attack. On the other hand, we kept bumping up against criminal restrictions, some of them very vague, some of them unclear, some of them the meaning of which, as applied to the war on terrorism, wasn't clear. And so we were always worried that we were going to constrain the president in a way that was going to get a lot of people killed. And that was the tension that he captured in that very colorful sentence.
Another sentence that's being quoted a lot from your book, you write that during a tense meeting at the White House in February of 2004, in referring to the Pfizer court, the court that has to approve warrants related to the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act, Addington said to you, "We're one bomb away from getting rid of that obnoxious court." People are interpreting that he just couldn't wait for the next bomb so that they could get rid of the Pfizer court. How do you interpret what he meant by that?
I don't think that's quite an accurate interpretation. I think that the gloss I would give is that he certainly did not like the FISA court. He thought that the entire FISA structure that required the commander-in-chief to go to a court to get a warrant to find out where the enemy was, he thought that was invalid and an unconstitutional infringement on the president's power. And he believed that FISA was constraining the president in a way that may get a lot of people killed. And I think what he meant by that was when the next attack comes and the next attack is attributable to a legal system that constrained the president, we'll get rid of that legal system. I think that's what he meant. He certainly wasn't. I should make clear, I certainly don't think that David Addington was couldn't wait for the next bomb to come. That certainly wasn't true. He worked a day and night very hard to try to prevent the terrorists from coming here and killing people. And so I think it would be a misinterpretation to say he couldn't wait for the next attack to come. That certainly isn't true. I think he thought that the legal constraints on the president were going to lead to another attack, and only the next attack would enable him to get rid of what he thought were invalid constraints.
You were part of a very dramatic scene that has recently come to light. When it was time to renew a program that was part of the War on Terror, John Ashcroft, who was then the Attorney General, and was very sick and in the hospital. He was in intensive care. James Comey, his deputy, who was the acting Attorney General while Ashcroft was incapacitated, didn't want to reauthorize the program. So when it was time to reauthorize it, Alberto Gonzalez, who was then the president's legal counsel, and Andrew Card, the president's chief of staff, tried to do an end run around Comey by going right to Ashcroft in intensive care and asking him to reauthorize the program. You got wind of this. You got wind of the fact that Gonzalez and Card were on the way, and you rushed to the hospital. Would you take the story from there?
Yes. The acting attorney general, Jim Comey, asked me to come to the hospital because he was... His decision in connection with the program was based on legal advice that I had given, and he agreed with my analysis. So I rushed to the hospital, rushed up to the Attorney General Ashcroft's room. Jim Comey and his deputy, Patrick Philbin, and I walked into the room. I was shocked to see the appearance of the Attorney General. I had seen him 10 days earlier. He had gone to the hospital about 10 days earlier. And maybe it was 5 or 10 days earlier. I don't know. I was shocked to see his appearance because he had lost a lot of weight. He was ashen. He had all sorts of wires and tubes coming out of him, and he just looked terrible. He'd had very serious surgery the day before. We were there just for a few moments before White House Counsel Gonzalez and Chief of Staff Andrew Card came into the room. It was a very brief encounter. They stood at the foot of his bed and asked him how he was doing. Alberto Gonzalez did the talking. Asked how the Attorney General was doing. He obviously wasn't doing well. And then basically expressed their view about the program in question and expressed their view about asking him to approve the program in question. At which point, the Attorney General sort of lifted himself up, sort of puffed up his chest, and color came into his face. And he gave an extraordinary 2-minute speech. I think it was about 2 minutes, in which he expressed his own concerns about what they were asking him to do and said he didn't appreciate them visiting him under these circumstances, and then turned to Jim Comey and said, and in any event, he's the Attorney General now, not me. And that was basically it. He collapsed back down into the bed, and he looked terrible, and I was worried. It was a very dramatic scene, and he had really sort of expended himself. And I was worried that, you know, that might be the end. I wasn't sure what was going to happen because he looked really terrible. And then Gonzalez and Card very quickly turned and walked out of the room, and that was it.
Now, what was your reaction and James Comey's reaction to this end run that the White House was trying to make around Comey, whose job it was at that point to decide whether to reauthorize this program or not?
Well, we all thought, everyone in the room thought it was inappropriate. To this day, I don't really understood what they thought they were accomplishing by asking the obviously incapacitated Attorney General John Ashcroft to authorize the program. We all thought it was inappropriate, and that was my basic reaction. Now, on their part, let me add, I think this is another example of how sort of desperately worried top officials were about having their hands tied and wanting to do something on the war on terrorism. So they were motivated by many things, but one of the things they were motivated by was they thought that we were acting in a way that was going to hamstring the president in keeping Americans safe, and that was the ever-present tension.
Well, you know, and it's also like, I know some people would interpret the action as they only want to hear what they want to hear, and they'll go to anyone they need to who will tell them that and avoid anyone they have to avoid who won't tell them what they want to hear. Is that an unfair interpretation?
I think that's... with respect, too simple an interpretation. These were not people who, the people in the White House were not people who were out to wreck the Constitution or wreck the law. They had a particular view of the president's power, and they had enormous responsibilities to keep the country safe. and they read threat reports every day that scared the wits out of them. And they were worried that there was going to be another 9/11. And when the bombs went off and a lot of people got killed, that's what they were worried about, because they knew they were going to be responsible for that. And they wanted to do absolutely everything they could to prevent it from happening. That's the more charitable way of looking at what they were doing.
But you were reading those threat reports, and you don't want us to get killed either, and neither did James Comey.
Right. That's true. That's absolutely true. And we were not happy about the legal conclusions we reached, and we were actually desperately unhappy about the legal conclusions we reached, and we tried very, very hard to find alternate ways to help the White House do what it wanted to do. But in the circumstances at the time, we simply could not sign off on everything that they wanted to do. But this is the great tension, I mean, between laws that limit the president that may keep him from doing things that keep America safe. And if a lot of people got killed, the lawyers would look, as I say in the book, stupid and silly for their stupid legalistic interpretations that tied the president's hands. I assure you that's the way it would look if a lot of people got killed because of what we did.
Jack Goldsmith speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Jack Goldsmith, recorded yesterday. Goldsmith is the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel, which advises the President and Attorney General on the legality of proposed actions.
When you took over as head of the Office of Legal Counsel, you had to review all of the policies, all of the legal opinions on the war on terror that the office had written. And here's one of the early ones that you quote. This was written by John Yoo on September 25th of 2001. And he wrote that Congress cannot, quote, place any limits on the president's determinations as to any terrorist threat, the amount of military force to be used in response, or the method, timing, and nature of the response. These decisions under our Constitution are for the president alone to make. And this memo, I think, is an example of the kind of broad presidential power that the White House has been seeking during the war on terror. Do you think that that memo is sound legal reasoning? Do you agree with the reasoning?
As I say in the book, most of the opinion, the September 25th, 2001 opinion, much of it I do agree with. The thrust of that opinion is about the president's power to thwart terrorist attacks and threaten terrorist attacks and potential terrorist attacks on his own without any affirmative authorization from Congress. And I certainly agree that the president has very, very broad powers to do that. The sentence you quoted is from near the end of the opinion, when it shifts to a different issue, not about whether the president can act in the absence of congressional authorization, but whether the president can act in the face of congressional constraints. And that sentence is a good example of the extraordinarily overbroad assertions of power. It moved from saying that the president can act against terrorists without affirmative authorization from Congress to saying that the president can act against terrorists and do whatever he wants, regardless of congressional restriction. And it was a throwaway paragraph at the end, and it didn't have any citations. Now, I certainly think that the president has powers vis-a-vis terrorists that Congress cannot limit, and especially in a crisis, and especially when the stakes are high. But that sentence that you read is extraordinarily broad, basically saying without qualification that the president can basically do whatever he wants against terrorists, and there's nothing Congress can do about it. It's just an overbroad and incautious statement of presidential power.
There were times when you advised that the president should go to Congress and have Congress sign off on certain programs, but David Addington, who was, again, then Vice President Cheney's legal counsel and is now his chief of staff, objected, and that Addington would always ask, when anyone proposed going to Congress, do we have the power to do it ourselves? And if so, let's not talk to Congress about it. It sounds like his emphasis was always as broad interpretation as possible of presidential power.
Yes, it was. I mean, in that respect, he believed that going to Congress to get Congress on board for any of the president's counterterrorism policies might result in Congress saying no, or might result in Congress not giving the president as much as he wanted. And not only would that leave the president in a worse position in terms of the powers he had against the terrorists, but would also, if they said no, the president would have fewer powers. And even the very act of going to Congress, he thought, suggested that the president might not have the power. So he opposed the act of going to Congress unless absolutely necessary, unless the president just couldn't do what he wanted to do. He just opposed going to Congress for anything.
The way you describe what was happening at the White House, that the White House was so pressured and is so pressured to protect us during this time of terrorism that they didn't want their powers to protect us reined in by Congress. So thus they tried to keep presidential powers broad and not go to Congress if they didn't have to, for fear that Congress would limit presidential power. But isn't it Congress's job, too, to worry about our safety and to protect us? And isn't it Congress's job to balance presidential powers in times like this, when we need to be protected?
Well, that's a deep question about the relevant roles of Congress and the president in wartime. And certainly Congress does have an important role, many important roles to play. So Congress does have a role, and I actually think the administration would have been a lot better off if it had gone to Congress on a lot of the issues earlier, especially detention, military commissions, surveillance. When the president did go to Congress in 2006 for the military commissions and 2007 for surveillance and made the case and tried to spread responsibility and to try to put Congress on the spot to exercise their constitutional responsibilities, he got everything he wanted and more. And it's just better for the system when possible, and especially when you're doing something in a new area that's so contested and when the courts are uncertain, it's always a better posture to go to Congress and get Congress on board. You spread the risk. Congress is going to be responsible to some degree if something goes wrong. But it does run the danger of Congress saying no or maybe or somehow not giving the president everything he wants and therefore, in some people's minds, leaving the president less off. Now, that wasn't my view. David Addington basically had the view that executive power, was the absence of constraint on power. And I think that's wrong. I think the president is more powerful, and I think history shows this with the Lincoln and the Roosevelt presidencies, that presidents are more powerful when they get Congress and the country more on board for what they're doing.
When you took over at the Office of Legal Counsel and read all the memos that were written for the Bush administration before you took over, you concluded that your predecessor's legal opinions were deeply flawed, sloppily reasoned, overbroad, and incautious in asserting extraordinary constitutional authorities on behalf of the president. You said, "I was astonished and immensely worried to discover that some of our most important counterterrorism policies rested on severely damaged legal foundations." And examples that you give of that are the now infamous torture memos. Would you just describe the two memos two torture memos that you tried to overturn?
Yes, one was written in August of 2002, and it was addressed from the Justice Department to the White House, and it was an interpretation of the torture statute, the criminal prohibition on torture in the federal statutes. And there was a second opinion written in March of 2003 from the Justice Department to the Department of Defense that contained a very similar analysis of the torture statute. So the question in the two opinions that I talk about in the book was the question of what is the proper interpretation of the prohibition, the criminal prohibition on torture, and that's what both opinions were about.
What did you think was badly reasoned about those opinions?
There were a lot of problems with the opinion, and I wouldn't have withdrawn and tried to replace them unless they were severely flawed, in my opinion, because it wasn't my job to go around looking for opinions that I disagreed with. The Office of Legal Counsel has a very powerful norm of abiding by its prior decisions, including prior decisions from other administrations, but especially within the own administration, within the same administration. And so I wasn't looking around to, find things that I disagreed with and could fix. That certainly wasn't my attitude at all. But when these came to my attention and I read and studied them and absorbed them, The thing that concerned me the most was the breadth of the opinion and the tone of the opinion, and especially the breadth because it went so, so far beyond and justified so, so much more than what I knew actually to be going on. And I thought that it had gone so far in a way that was erroneous. So I worried, even though I knew what was going on, I worried that the underlying practices and techniques, I worried that the opinion would be used by someone out there somewhere to justify much, much more aggressive interrogation practices. And that was my main concern in the end of the day.
Jack Goldsmith speaking to Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Epic of the Founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, why Jack Goldsmith resigned from the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel after retracting two now infamous torture memos written before he headed the office. Also, David Edelstein reviews 310 to Yuma, and we have a review of the Curb Your Enthusiasm season premiere, as well as a new series and a new special, all on HBO this weekend. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. We're continuing Terry's interview with Jack Goldsmith, whose new book is called The Terror Presidency, Law and Judgment Inside the Bush Administration. In October 2003, Goldsmith was appointed to head the Office of Legal Counsel, which advises the president and attorney general on whether the president's plans can be implemented legally. Shortly after his arrival, Goldsmith began to examine and reevaluate some key opinions issued by his predecessor. Two of them, now known as the torture memos, Goldsmith retracted as being deeply flawed legal arguments. 9 months after joining the OLC, Goldsmith resigned. Terry spoke with him yesterday.
Now that August 2002 memo, had to do with the standard for qualifying as torture, and it said to qualify as torture, The pain must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury, such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. And you say that that language actually had a very surprising source, having to do with what, health policy or something? Would you tell us where that language came from?
So the Office of Legal Counsel was trying to interpret the phrase severe pain. The torture statute prohibits severe pain. So the question is, and it's a very hard question, what counts as severe pain? And so they looked around other parts of the U.S. Code for other statutes, and they found the phrase severe pain, as you just described it, used in a statute that actually authorizes health benefits. So it was obviously about something quite different. But sometimes it's appropriate when trying to figure out the meanings of words in one statute to see how they're used in the other. But the way, in my opinion, the way that the health benefit statute used severe pain had no relationship whatsoever to the torture statute. And in fact, it wasn't even really giving a definition of severe pain. It was talking about severe pain as a sign of an emergency condition that, if not treated, might cause organ failure and the like. It didn't say that severe pain was pain equivalent in intensity to organ failure. And I don't even think that makes sense to apply that idea in the context of the torture statute.
You also say you didn't like the tendentious tone of the torture memos. What was wrong with the tone?
Well, the tone is really important. The Office of Legal Counsel, it's very important for the Office of Legal Counsel to take a very detached attitude towards legal interpretation and to appear to take a very detached attitude towards legal interpretation. And this opinion, as one senior official in the Justice Department put it to me, wasn't the usual detached OLC analysis, but rather, as this person put it, read like a bad defense counsel's brief. It was basically read as if it were stretching to find ways to immunize people who were going to be doing very, very aggressive interrogations. And that was instead of doing a kind of neutral, detached analysis of the meaning of the torture statute, and in parts it did try to do that, it had a discussion about defenses to prosecution and self-defense and the like that seemed extraneous to the interpretation of the torture law.
So you wanted to withdraw these torture memos because you didn't think that they had a sound legal basis. Were there any precedents for the head of the Office of Legal Counsel to withdraw decisions that were made within the same administration that he was serving?
There may have been some, but I couldn't find any. And so I quickly concluded that these opinions were flawed and needed to be withdrawn and replaced. But doing it was very, very tricky because I really didn't have any roadmap about how to do this. And the difficult part was, of course, that, let me emphasize, I had not concluded that the techniques that were being used, the actual interrogation techniques, were unlawful. I was more worried. My first and primary worry was for what else might be going on that I didn't know about in the name of these opinions. But as you say, there was no precedent, no roadmap for withdrawing and replacing them. And so there were a lot of hard judgment calls about timing and the appropriate approach to withdrawing the opinions. I couldn't just say, okay, I've concluded these things are wrong, I'm going to withdraw them, and then we can move on from there. So many people had relied on them. These programs had been vetted throughout the highest levels of government and briefed to Congress. And I couldn't just come along and say, well, I disagree with this now. We have to start all over. So actually withdrawing and replacing them was one of the trickiest things I did.
How did you do
it? My basic approach after talking to some colleagues in the Justice Department was to not withdraw the opinion until I concluded, had done what I thought was a proper legal analysis so that I could tell the agencies in question what they could and couldn't do. And this was very easy with regard to the Department of Defense because the Department of Defense had relied on these very broad Justice Department opinions to approve 24 techniques that I was able to quickly determine were lawful. And so I called the general counsel of the Department of Defense, and I said to him that I told him that the opinion had some errors, that we were withdrawing it, that he shouldn't rely on it, but that we've done an independent analysis, and the 24 techniques that they had been using we had determined were lawful, and that he could continue to use those techniques, and therefore that, as far as I could tell, nothing would have to change in the actual interrogation techniques. And I told him not to rely on the old opinions or do any other techniques without coming back to the Justice Department. So that worked pretty well. It was much harder with regard to what President Bush called the tough interrogation techniques being used by the Central Intelligence Agency. And I'm obviously not at liberty to talk about those techniques, but those techniques were closer to the legal line. I never determined that they were unlawful, but figuring out it was much harder to apply the torture statute to figure out whether they were lawful or not. It took a much longer time to do that, and I had many, many, many things on my plate that were, believe it or not, more consequential than that. And so I didn't get around to fixing those, unfortunately, until after the Abu Ghraib scandal and after the opinions leaked, at which point I was obviously under enormous pressure to stand by the opinions because the administration was receiving a lot of heat for them. But I couldn't stand by the opinions because I had determined 6 months earlier that they were flawed.
So what did you do?
After deliberating for about a week, I decided that I had to withdraw them even before I could get a replacement opinion, as much as I didn't want to do that. And because I simply could not defend the opinions, no one inside or outside the administration was really defending the opinions. It was very hard to do. And so I just withdrew them, and I said that they can't be relied on anymore.
You also resigned at the same time. Why did you resign then?
I had been thinking, as I say in the book, I had been thinking for quite a long time about resigning, and I was going to resign in this period in any event. And really, announcing my resignation to the Attorney General and to the White House at the time that I withdrew the opinion was designed primarily to make sure that my decision about the interrogation opinions stuck and weren't overruled by the White House. I had, in an earlier episode when I had had a confrontation with the White House, they had put up enormous resistance, extraordinary resistance to a decision to try to put something on what I thought was a firmer legal basis. And I didn't want to go through that again. I didn't think it was appropriate. And so, and ultimately, it's the president's call, obviously, but I decided that I felt importantly that it was important enough that that I really felt it should stick, and I thought it would be harder for them to reverse me if I resigned.
Because it would look like you were resigning in protest, and
in
it would
protest,
be a big
yes.
public story.
Yes. It was a big public story anyway, but that would have been an even bigger public story.
So did you resign really quietly and keep it a secret that you were the one who was withdrawing these Office of Legal Counsel torture memos?
I certainly didn't talk to anyone publicly about it. And, you know, soon after I withdrew, about the week after I had both withdrawn the opinions and resigned, you know, a lot of people in my staff in the Office of Legal Counsel came to me and said they thought that I had resigned in protest over the withdrawal of the opinions. They thought that I had been ordered to withdraw them and had resigned in protest over that decision. And obviously, the opposite was the truth, and I explained that to my staff. I didn't talk about it for a long time. I actually don't think I've talked about it until this book.
Why not?
When I got out of government, I was very, very timid and shy and worried about talking about any of my service in government. And I thought that the best posture for me to take was just to keep quiet. I did a lot of thinking and reading about the presidency, and I decided after a couple of years that also in that period, a lot of stuff came out in the public. A lot of issues that I was at the center of were debated and talked about publicly by the administration, by Congress, in testimony and otherwise, by scholars and pundits and the like. And I ultimately decided to write about it because it had been talked about so much by everyone else in government and elsewhere, and because I thought I had some things to say that I thought really weren't being focused on and that I thought might be useful for people in the future who are in my position trying to navigate this terrible tension between complying with the law and keeping the country safe.
Jack Goldsmith speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Jack Goldsmith, recorded yesterday. Goldsmith is the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel, which advises the President and Attorney General on the legality of proposed actions.
You know, you write in your book a lot about trying to find the balance between keeping everything on the war on terror legal and keeping presidential powers within legal limits, but at the same time not over-lawyering the war in a way that makes intelligence agencies and the military too constrained and forces them to be too risk-averse. Can you talk a little bit about the difficulties of finding that balance?
Yes, I'm glad you asked me about this. It's really one of the central problems that the government faces, and it's something that I was involved in and unfortunately contributed to. The intelligence agencies are under enormous pressure to do everything they can to stop an attack. But everywhere they look, they see these criminal laws. And it's very, very, very difficult to know how far to push in the face of some of these sometimes vague criminal laws, especially when you're under enormous pressure to do as much as you can. The result is we've had more and more and more laws that restrict the president's power in wartime. More and more of them are criminal laws. That means that they're going to be interpreted long after the events in question under, you know, in the context of danger and threat in which actions were taken. The worry that a lot of people had was, you know, we're going to do something now that's aggressive but that we think is legal, but that later it's going to be determined not to be legal, and then we're going to get in trouble or it's going to be controversial. The CIA has gone through this for 25 years. This has happened time and time again where they're asked to do something aggressively that they're told they can do, and then later or not, they get severely reprimanded for it. And that tension, that dynamic, is really what led to a lot of the risk aversion that dominated the intelligence community and that a lot of people after 9/11 complained about, the risk aversion that led us to be less aggressive than we could have, perhaps, against the terrorists before 9/11. And it's a tension that's still present. It's a huge problem for our intelligence agencies. And it gives a lot of power to lawyers. Sometimes you're going to have lawyers who are basically the CIA, as Michael Scheuer, the head of the Bin Laden unit, said recently, you don't go to the bathroom in the CIA without getting permission from a lawyer. Everything they do in the CIA, everything they do in the military, gets approval from a lawyer. And what that means is that the counterterrorism policies that we take, lawyers have a lot of influence over because they can say yes or they can say no. And either one of those answers can be wrong. It's just a very big problem for members of the government asked to do very aggressive things to keep us safe, but also being told, but be careful, because if you cross this vague line, you're going to get in trouble for it.
Jack Goldsmith, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Jack Goldsmith, speaking to Terry Gross yesterday. For 9 months in 2003 and 2004, he was head of the Office of Legal Counsel for the Bush administration. Today, he teaches law at Harvard University. This month, Hollywood is going back to the classic Western genre. In 2 weeks, with Brad Pitt in The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, and this week with 310 to Yuma, an Elmore Leonard story that was filmed once before with Glenn Ford and Van Heflin. The new version stars Russell Crowe and Christian Bale. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
310 to Yuma is adapted from a 50s Elmore Leonard short story, back when he wrote Westerns. Leonard's tale is set in Contention, Arizona, where a deputy waits in a hotel with an outlaw. They have to catch a train to prison, the 310 to be exact. As the bad guy's vicious buddies amass in the street, obviously to liberate him, the outlaw tells the deputy it's not worth dying for his paltry salary, especially with a wife and kids. He says, save yourself. And the deputy says, I have a job to do. A 1957 movie expanded the saga and made the outlaw a charismatic leader. It's no classic, but its deep-focused black-and-white cinematography is striking, and there's even a theme song by Frankie Lane. The new adaptation, directed by James Mangold, is busier and boasts a higher body count, lots of splatter. It's also morally rigged in ways I'll get to. But it has two things in its favor. The first is simply genre, the nostalgia many of us feel for Westerns in which heroes struggle to cling to their ideals in a craven society. And it has Russell Crowe. Crowe's life has overshadowed his performances, but there is a link between his acting and unruly behavior. Crowe doesn't stand outside his characters. He goes so deep, I think his DNA must change. He's undefended, open in a way that's childlike and touching. He can access volatile emotions more quickly than almost any actor I've seen. In 310 to Yuma, he plays Ben Wade, gang leader and murderer, and it's the closest he's come to giving an ironic performance. But Crow's irony is intense. He's so craftily understated, with such soft, laughing eyes, that he upstages everyone. His good guy antagonist, Dan Evans, is played by Christian Bale, who's just as committed as Crow, but a lot more earnest. The movie opens with Dan's family's barn being burned. They're in debt and don't want to sell to a big rancher, and you know the drill. For money, he takes a job getting Wade to contention with a Pinkerton agent played by Peter Fonda. The former counterculture star entertainingly channels Clint Eastwood and John Wayne. It's a long, twisty odyssey, but the dramatic core is still, as in Leonard's story, two men waiting for a train.
Just lay down your gun and let me walk out the door. It's worth $400 to me.
Is that what you reckon my price is?
No. No, I reckon it's $1,000.
Isn't that kind of reckless of you, Wade? Seeing as you're so sure that your crew's coming to get you?
Well, they're coming down. Sure as God's vengeance, they're coming. But I just like to do things easy.
Well, you tell me, Wade, how would I account for that amount of money? What would I tell people when I spend it? That you got the jump on me, you escaped, and somehow I got a fortune. No. How dumb you think people are?
Nobody needs to know.
That's a terrific scene, and there are others, in dark saloons with swinging doors and bottles of whiskey that have an amber glow, and in the bedroom of a beautiful prostitute who brings out something yearning in the outlaw. She makes him self-destructive enough to stick around and be captured. But there's too much of everything in 310 to Yuma, too much extraneous sadism, too many escapes and recaptures. Plus, the deputy has a son who tags along, so there's cornball sentiment, too. Mangold has no feel for landscape. He relies on volleys of tight close-ups. He won't let the movie breathe. A larger problem is that Crow's Wade turns out to be the film's moral center. We know he's a murderer, but we never see him kill anyone who doesn't, in the ethics of the Western, deserve it. The climax is ridiculous for reasons I won't go into, and reminiscent of another recent movie I won't mention. Crow is a hoot to the end, though. The actor with the volcanic emotions turns the notion of having few emotions, of being beyond caring, into a bloody great joke. He almost makes you believe this corrupt Western has integrity, too.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, I look at three new shows premiering on HBO this weekend. This is Fresh Air. HBO is unveiling three new programs this Sunday. One is an envelope-pushing new drama series called Tell Me You Love Me. Another is a documentary featuring interviews with Iraq war veterans. And the third is the season premiere of Curb Your Enthusiasm. In my opinion as a TV critic, they're worth paying attention to individually, but also for what HBO is trying to do by presenting them all at once. HBO started the summer by ending The Sopranos in shockingly abrupt fashion, with the series cutting back to black just before James Gandolfini's Tony either got killed or ate another onion ring. That night, HBO also premiered its new series John from Cincinnati by David Milch. But if the end of The Sopranos didn't confuse people, John from Cincinnati sure did. So now, it's the end of the summer. John from Cincinnati has come, gone, and been canceled. HBO needs to establish its next beachhead, and it's trying to do so this Sunday. It's premiering a new drama series, Tell Me You Love Me, that has gotten most of its attention for sex scenes that are surprisingly graphic for television. HBO also is unveiling a new documentary about soldiers severely wounded during the war in Iraq, a program produced by and featuring James Gandolfini in his first HBO project since The Sopranos ended. And sandwiched between those two very serious programs is the season premiere of Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm, which has been absent from HBO for far too long. Curb doesn't disappoint. It's as sharp and clever and edgy as ever. Also, for a show with a reputation for being improvised, it's more tightly plotted than most series on TV. Every episode is full of elements that come together at the end, and the same goes for the ongoing storyline that runs through each season. This season, it's the way Larry and his TV wife Cheryl, played by Larry David and Cheryl Hines, shelter an African-American family left homeless by a hurricane down south. If that sounds like Larry has lost his edge, don't worry. Here he is, arriving with Cheryl at the airport, hours late, to greet the refugee family.
Hi. Are you waiting for the Davids by any chance?
Yes. You are.
Yeah, wake up, baby.
Oh, my
wake
goodness.
Up, Auntie Ray. We're so sorry we're late.
Oh,
so
things
sorry.
Happen. They do.
Well, you know, traffic, and you'll see in Los Angeles, it's terrible.
That's right. I'm so Loretta sorry. Black.
Hi, Larry. Yeah. Hi.
This is my Auntie Ray.
Hello. Hi, I'm
These
Larry.
Are my kids, Keisha and Daryl.
Keisha and Daryl. Yeah. So let me see. Your last name is Black.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's like if my last name was Jew, like Larry Jew. Because I'm Jewish.
On the other edge of the emotional spectrum is the documentary Alive Day Memories, Home from Iraq, a program that's as powerful as it is intimate. It includes home movies, an even horrifying video of explosions, photographed as well as planned by insurgents. Most of Alive Day, though, takes place on a bare off-Broadway stage, as Gandolfini sits and talks quietly, one at a time, with 10 war veterans. Some are missing limbs. Some have severe brain injuries, and all have stories to tell that deserve to be heard. The term Alive Day refers to the day they narrowly escaped death, and Gandolfini asks questions with an impressive, and to be honest, totally unexpected, sensitivity and skill. For a guy who doesn't like being interviewed, Gandolfini sure is a natural interviewer. And both he and the program's producers and directors make sure the focus is never on him, always on the veterans. As it should be. Those two shows, Curb and Alive Day Memories, are recommended without hesitation. Tell Me You Love Me, on the other hand, is a mixed effort. It's gotten almost all its attention for its sex scenes, but those are the scenes that, for me, tend to shatter the believability of the rest of the drama. When the images get too graphic, you stop looking at the characters and suddenly think about the actors and actresses playing the characters. Jane Alexander plays a couples therapist, and by halfway through the first season, she's advising most of the other characters on the show. A couple in its 20s is engaged, but wrestling with infidelity. A couple in its 30s is trying to have a baby, but dealing with infertility. And a couple in its 40s, seemingly happy with children, is troubled by incompatibility. They're not having sex, which, in Tell Me You Love Me, is a real rarity. Here's the husband, played by Tim DeKay, finally venting his frustrations to the therapist, as his wife, played by Allie Walker, looks on in increasing horror.
You know what? I should be in the mood every time I clean out the gecko cage. Everybody else is, it seems. You know what else turns me on? I'll tell you what turns me on. Buying Cheerios is really hot. And then, of course, going and getting shoelaces or fantasizing about minivans. That's sexy, too. I really want to do that. It's excellent foreplay. Or you know what else is good foreplay? When you are comparing apple juice prices and they both don't even want to be in the grocery store, but you know you got to get back because they got to be fed before they go to bed. And then at bed, all you're doing is just reading to them, probably and telling them the same damn story for the 100th time. Then after all that, then I am ready to have sex, because all that is so hot.
our entire life. That's what you just trashed. Our entire life.
Obviously, it's a different type of complaining than Larry David does on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And once again, I'm not sure HBO has found the right programs to pair together on a key Sunday evening. Curb and Alive Day Memories are a lock. But Tell Me You Love Me, while series creator Cynthia Mort and the impressive actors must be given points for boldness, isn't likely to be loved by everyone. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart by Ian Ayers. More at supercrunchers.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsett, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, on DVD September 11th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the tortured relationship between Robert F. Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover in the 1960s. Writer Burton Hirsch says that as Attorney General, Kennedy tried to keep his FBI director on a short leash, but Hoover's knowledge of Kennedy family secrets gave him the upper hand. Hirsch has a new book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.